Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Recent data from the U.S. Census Bureau shows that Indians make up the second fastest growing population of immigrants in the U.S., and St. Louis is among the top 15 American cities that is experiencing an increase in the number of Indian immigrants building new lives and raising families in America. But these newer local neighbors are joining many Indian Americans who have long made their homes in STL or more recently arrived after living in other parts of the country. And as a whole, the population is remarkably and complexly diverse. So when and where and how Indian Americans engage around politics is similarly varied. There's no monolithic, quote, Indian American vote. And that goes as much for Vice President Kamala Harris, who's running to be the next American president and the first of Indian descent, as any other candidate vying for office. To talk about this, we have three Indian American guests who'll share personal perspectives. First, we welcome Arindam Kaur, attorney and 25-ish year resident of St. Louis. Arindam's been on the show a number of times as a guest for our monthly legal roundtable. It's great to have you here, Arindam.
Thank you.
We also have Meera Nagarajan. Meera is a journalist and travel advisor born in Urbana, Illinois. Her family moved to St. Louis in the 90s. Meera's also been on the show many, many times to talk about food during her many years with Sauce Magazine. Meera, welcome back.
Thank you.
And last but certainly not least, we have Jacob Chacko. Jacob is executive director of the Center for Diversity and Inclusion and the interim director of the Spectrum Office at Washington University. Jacob is about a year and a half into living in St. Louis. He was born in Kerala, India, and immigrated to and grew up in the Chicago suburb of Skokie, Illinois. Jacob, welcome back to the Midwest and welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk first about politics' place in your families and communities. And Arindam, I'd like to begin with you. How was it that politics was discussed in your family as you grew up there in Iowa?
Yeah, I think politics was a central part of our conversations growing up, largely led by my father, but my mother was also involved. I was blessed with coming from family that were involved in the independence movement in India. So there was always a little bit of that undertone of politics and things of that nature. And then as I was growing up, I remember my father taking me to a Ronald Reagan rally in Waterloo, Iowa at the National Cattle Congress in like 83 or 84. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the political acuity because I think at school I voted for Mondale. But nonetheless, it did spark my passion for discussing issues and, you know, sort of what the future of this country may hold, especially for my parents who really made this our home and how we could be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. And presidential politics in Iowa were very big then, and more so than they are now because of the caucuses, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, the caucus certainly has its challenges and issues in terms of access and equity, but nonetheless a very unique framework to talk with your neighbors about politics. And, you know, I got involved when I went back to Iowa for law school. And so, yeah, definitely a different take than just going to a voting booth.
Right, right. Meera, how much of that resonates with you? I mean, what was the place that politics had as you were growing up, like the conversations that were happening or maybe not happening in your home?
I think my dad was similar to what you had said. My dad was really the one in our household that was very interested in politics. He would have the news on, and that was very important to him. And I would also say that when we would go to people's homes, you know, for dinner or whatever it is, my parents would be like, we're all going, you know, your friends will be there. So we would also have an ear on like the conversations surrounding politics that the men in those social circles would have. And mm-hmm. I think it was a very diverse kind of, you know, they had a lot of different perspectives, but a lot of them, you know, still cared about Indian politics very much and had the point of view of like, how does American politics and what's happening here today affect, you know, the U.S.-Indian relations. And I think that really did color their points of view on American politics as it relates to, like, their connections back home and how they felt about politics in India.
Mm-hmm. So, Jacob, for you, having been born in Kerala and mm-hmm. coming to the U.S. when you were 9, what were the things that you were hearing in India, like, as a child?
Yeah.
Like, and how does it relate to what we've just heard?
First, let me start by saying Happy Indigenous Peoples Day to
yes.
everyone.
Thank you.
So Kerala, where I'm from, to this day, I think is still some form of communist government that I remember waiting in lines with ration cards with my siblings and my mom growing up. So that I don't think that's a future my family wanted for us. And so we came to the U.S. For better opportunities. So mm-hmm. my aunt came here in the late 60s, maybe 70s, I don't even know what year, as a nurse, and then applied for my dad, and then my dad applied for us to come. So we came. I had no clue where I was or what an airplane was mm-hmm. until I got on one. So coming to the States and growing up in Skokie and going to public school, you know, I was still barely grasping this newness of what all of this meant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember conversations, maybe because there were things that my parents witnessed in India that kept them from wanting to talk about that here in the U.S. But I will say my lived experience had a major part to play in how I got involved and how politics became a part of my everyday life, right? Mm-hmm. 9/11 happened when I was in sophomore in high school. And so the next day, 9/12 was very, very important. 9/11 was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But 9/12, they started rounding up people that looked like me, right? And I remember as a kid cutting out the U.S. flag from the newspaper and hanging it on my front window of our house so that we weren't targeted, because I was witnessing that was happening in a lot of our different countries, from our Sikh community to the Muslim community. And so I saw how Indian Americans in particular and Desis in general were being talked about at school and neighborhoods and communities. And so I became activated because of the experiences that I was having and the because of the ways that I looked. The second biggest kind of experience that I can think back to is the church. So I grew up Syrian Orthodox Christian,
mm-hmm.
A faith that I no longer practice, that I've left. But I remember, you know, never really talked or in the pulpit or preached about politics much at church, but I very particularly remember one conference that they brought in some people to talk about sexual health to the teens but to the parents, really around what family life and family planning meant. And it was from a very Republican party standpoint, and they were very confident in advertising it as such for that convention.
Right.
And that really put me off from kind of the false information they were teaching the youth around sexual health. And so that kind of put me away, and then it didn't align with kind of what I leaned towards coming out as queer in high school and identifying with the community. Already kind of set me aside from the community that I was a part of.
Right.
So all these factors.
Yeah. Well, I think that gets to sort of the way that institutions that we are part of.
Correct.
From a time when we're young and where this is happening
mm-hmm.
in the country. We're in the Midwest, that there is a lot of relevance there that maybe doesn't get talked about. Arindam, as you were talking about, you know, the first rally that you had gone to with your father
mm-hmm.
and the politics that he had at that time, something that you had mentioned in the bio that you shared with all of us had to do with citizenship and then voting and how it was for your mother. And this is sort of related, I think, to a gender point that we'll return to, Mira, with you. What is her story, and what does it What does it deliver as far as a message that people should be thinking about? Not when it is a discussion about younger voters, but for older people who become American citizens.
Sure, sure. No, great question. I think for my father, his political activation in terms of actually voting was a combination of some of it was work-related. It was very tough to travel globally on an Indian passport, so having a U.S. passport made it easier. But also, I saw a transition with him. And again, this, I think, reflects some of the conversations we had as I was becoming more politically mature. You know, he was very much a product of the benefits of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, mm-hmm. really sort of catering to a educated elite Asian population to come here, and they fit very well into this model minority myth. And part of that, I think, education for my father was, he was like, well, I'm here, I'm supposed to be successful, I'm different than other immigrants, so I should vote Republican.
Mm-hmm.
But that transition really changed as he got a better understanding of, I think, values that were important to him, what really triggered him in terms of activation. And that ultimately did lead him to get his citizenship. And, you know, he did change political affiliations. My mother, on the other hand, and again, this is similar to what I think Mira said, at a lot of these parties that we would go to within the community, it would be the men that would talk politics. But there was an activation for my mother as well. She retained her Indian citizenship well after, you know, having a green card, because that was her connection back to her homeland and to her family. But it wasn't until the 2004 election where she was like, you know, I need to do something, and finally went through the process to become a citizen to vote. And mm-hmm. she got really active after that, and she and I would then start to have a lot of conversations that maybe previously were largely between my father and me, and she would, you know, maybe interject every once in a while, but not particularly.
Yeah. So, Mira, the women, right, you grew up around, who are part of these gatherings where the men mostly were talking, as you grew older, did you come to some realization that they were actually more concerned about certain issues? Like, as Jacob had talked about, that there were certain issues that really that put them in a place to understand what they could do by participating in the voting process or in other sort of activities that were focused on social interests that they had?
I think that I remember when both of my parents became citizens. And similar to most people, I would think, once you become a citizen, like, voting becomes very important to you. It becomes a responsibility that you feel a sense of, you know, duty to. And so I think that's when I noticed my mom becoming more engaged in politics and watching the news. She mostly, I think, consumes her news from Indian news.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting to talk to her about how she sees American politics and news, because she gets it through the lens of an Indian perspective. But specifically, no, I think that citizenship really was the activation for a lot of the women that I know in our like immediate St. Louis community.
Mm-hmm. And for what it's worth, that eventual citizenship is really the thing that I was thinking about mm-hmm. as we were putting this all together, because we started with an introduction about how many Indian immigrants are here already and how many more will be coming. And so on that note, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see Time is of the essence.
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back. Let's return to our conversation about St. Louis's Indian community and the way this diverse population is reacting in this political moment. I'm joined by attorney Arindam Kaur and journalist Meera Nagarajan, and also with me is Jacob Chacko. He's executive director of the Center for Diversity and Inclusion at Washington University. So, Washington Post columnist Bina Venkataraman wrote last week about her experience of talking to Indian American voters in Georgia, where there's a huge population there of Indian Americans and Desi Americans, right, more broadly. And she wanted to answer the question, would their pride in the vice president's heritage drive them to the polls? And she found something complicated. She wrote, "When I embarked on my reporting for this column, I suspected wrongly that support for Trump among Indian Americans in suburban Georgia would map onto support for Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, given the authoritarian impulses of both men and their notorious bromance. But when I asked people about this, they earnestly distinguished their sentiments about the two figures, regardless of whether they were voting red or blue." What is it that you make of her, you know, quote, suspicion or maybe assumption linking political views in India to those here in America? And what's off base about that, Meera?
I mean, I think when I've talked to people here about, or even abroad, like my family, I actually reached out to all of my family on the WhatsApp chat. I'm sure everybody has one. About the similar idea, and nearly all of them said they have a great sense of pride in her political rise, but they mostly care about what an incoming administration would do for India. That's like their general concern. Like, mm-hmm. how would this incoming administration, whether it was left or right, work with the Modi government? And whatever administration would do that best is what they would be, so, you know, rooting for, regardless of race. When I've talked to people here about this topic, I feel like, yes, there is this initial pride, but it's people still vote based off of their, like, beliefs. Mm-hmm. I also think that gender bias came into play in such a big way, more so than I found race to be a determining factor or a swaying factor, rather.
Yeah. Jacob.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw you nodding your head quite a bit there.
Absolutely. No, for me, I think in my circles and the spaces that I'm in higher education, you know, for us, representation is doesn't equal liberation, right? And so for a lot of the folks, whether it's Kamala or Vivek or Bobby Jindal, time and time again, folks are seeing that, you know, for some people in the community, they are a representation of their beliefs and values. For a large majority that I'm connected to, it's not.
Right.
And so, like Meera is mentioning, there's definitely gender politics at play. There's, you know, people's values in question, right? What is Kamala's stance on genocide? What is her stance on different communities, immigration, for example? So it's really up in the air. It's not a monolith as a lot of folks are thinking about. Mm-hmm. Well, do all Indian Americans feel this particular way, or they see Americans in general? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Right.
So I want to bring it very close to home, to Missouri. Mm-hmm. And in this state, the first statewide office holder, that is, in Missouri, who is a person of color, is State Treasurer Vivek Malak, who is Indian American, and he is Indian American by naturalization. He was born in India. He is someone who is very much not pro-Harris. He is pro-Trump, and he has said, quote, "I proudly stand with President Trump as an early endorser and surrogate. I campaigned for him in Iowa. believing in his mission, or his vision, that is, to keep Missouri and America first. Together, we can champion the values that make our country exceptional. He's also said, "I'm blessed to have truly lived the American dream. I owe so much to America and Missouri, and I want to give back. America's a place of unlimited possibilities where you can achieve anything if you work hard and get an education. This is the American dream." Arindam, earlier you had mentioned the model minority myth. In your experience living here in St. Louis now for, you know, about 25 years or so, like all together, and growing up in Iowa, how much of a factor does that continue to be among Indian Americans who were born here, and hearing some of the conversations maybe that have gone on among the elders in their different communities? It could be at family, it could be in church, or, right. Yeah.
No, I, what the treasurer said in terms of his basis for whom he's supporting is something that I think many of us have heard. I do think that, at least from my perspective, there is a bit of a generational divide. Those who are a little bit older, who emigrated here, that are very much lockstep in that perception, which. It, again, my opinion may be a little bit myopic of the American dream, that, you know, sort of the bootstrap argument, not appreciating some of the other factors, which I think at a different generation, those that have been born here generationally a bit younger might have a broader perspective. Now, they may still nonetheless maybe vote in this election for President Trump, but they might have a broader perspective on that. So I do think there are some complexities there. I think, as Jacob said, some of the issues that maybe elder Indian Americans are contemplating versus younger Indian Americans are contemplating are different, you know, issues such as, again, you know, we have three panelists here, none of us speak the same native tongue. We have different religions here. India has the third largest Muslim population in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so a Muslim Indian American may have a very different perspective on some conversations of key issues that others won't. So I think it just delves into a little bit of the complexities that once you start unfolding and unpeeling some of those issues, you see how complex that can be in terms of what your ultimate determination is in terms of for whom you may vote.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to note here that Vivek Malek is 47 years old. So I thought it would be important to mention that. Mira, you raised a finger over here.
Yeah, I think that a lot of what I've noticed is for people that immigrated to the United States, especially after the 1965 legislation that really unlocked immigration for Indians and gave a pathway to citizenship and bringing your spouse over, I feel like that generation of people that came after that time period, like my parents in the 70s, I feel like they have this bootstrap attitude for sure. They just feel like, well, we made this huge effort. We did it the right way, like quote unquote right way. Mm-hmm. And the path towards citizenship was a long one. So I think that they do have this this kind of understanding with a more conservative perspective surrounding mm-hmm. immigration because of how difficult and how long their path to citizenship for many of them were. I think for people like me who were second generation, we've had the privilege of being born in this country. We don't have the same set of tools that were needed to, you know, get to a path to citizenship like they did. So we have a little bit more of a liberal standpoint just because we saw their struggle, and then we have this perspective of growing up here. So we have a little bit more, I would say, of like a more a worldview that's different than our parents, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Jacob?
There's also fear, right? I think what my parents' generation and myself, they witnessed whatever they went through in communist Kerala and decided to come here for a better future. I remember a time, if folks are familiar with Devon Avenue in Chicago, it was, still is a vibrant Indian and Desi neighborhood, right? I remember the immigration raids of the 90s, right? There was a vibrancy that was lost over a weekend when ICE whatever it was called back then, raided over the weekend, and a lot of people were deported. Mm-hmm. And so fear from that, fear from the impacts of 9/11, I think, also are a driving factor on how people choose to participate in politics. I think we earlier had this conversation around citizenship and having that right to vote. Mm-hmm. I became naturalized under my mom, and I think it was my pushing for them to actually participate. But there was and still is that sense of fear of, like, our citizenship, although we're U.S. citizens, could be revoked at any day. That's still very present. Mm-hmm. And we saw that with the Muslim ban, right? And we don't know what else is to come. So there's still acting out of fear as well, that there is this other aspect too.
Mm-hmm. Arindam, you're nodding.
No, I agree. I have that very same fear when you hear some of the rhetoric on potential changes to immigration. And again, we could have three different sessions on immigration alone, much less the Indian American perspective. But again, I think from the perspectives that we're coming from, we all had parents that immigrated here for education or opportunity. But I think it's important to note that, you know, one of the things that makes the immigration discussion so complex, it's not just about reunification through visas and whatnot. I mean, if you look at the southern border, I think the third largest population that is crossing across the southern border is from the Indian subcontinent. Mm-hmm. In Canada, it's, I think the immigration or the migration from the northern border, the Indian subcontinent population is one of the largest percentages, much smaller in numbers, but nonetheless. So it is not a, you know, simple discussion of just visas and H-1B visas. These are the same struggles every other voter is going through. How do we solve this immigration issue? And that's where I think a lot of the complexities come in from our perspectives, our parents' perspectives, and what we think is the right way for this country to move forward.
Mm-hmm. At the top of the show, we mentioned, you know, that Indians are the fastest growing immigrant group to St. Louis, and that growth, you know, of course, it's going to take time. But are there any real ways that you have seen the political influence not only of Indian immigrants, those who are green card holders, but those who are, you know, are citizens? How is that being reflected in politics here? Or, you know, do you think it's going to take a certain number of years to see that sort of shape what's happening locally or at the state level? Arindam?
Well, as you said, we have a person in state politics of Indian descent. I don't know if, and again, I'm only been here a couple of decades in Missouri, but I don't think I would have envisioned that. So mm-hmm. I do think we're starting to see that. I think we're starting to have a realization, even if the numbers are small in Missouri and St. Louis, they're nonetheless, from a national perspective, within, you know, sort of the top section of when you rank states in terms of population growth. I think we're starting to see in this community and Missouri at large a understanding that there is a political voice within that community. It won't be singular, but nonetheless an appreciation that if this is my home, I have a community here now, and I want to impact that community, and how do I activate it? It's not simply living in fear and keeping quiet and just keeping the status quo, but I may need to voice my opinion, whether that is through financial means of supporting or even running for state, local, or national office.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say one thing you can't tell Indian people not to do. We don't have a function,
okay.
Whether you tell us or not, right? So I'm seeing it in the political spectrum. I'm seeing candidates locally in Creve Coeur. I see like school, either on the school board or local. I just had a flyer on my door the other day with the They See American candidate on on the ballot, vote for XYZ person. So I think it's happening. I think we're seeing it. But I also see us building community here in St. Louis, right? There's a vibrant Malayali community, interfaith community that's hosting Onam programs. That's one thing that I love about our community is that wherever we are, we're going to get together and we're going to eat our food and we're going to celebrate. And you see that And we were just talking earlier before starting about the vibrancy of, like, the food scene here in St. Louis with our community getting together.
Mm-hmm. So as we close here, I'd like a word from each of you. Do you think that the candidacy in particular of Kamala Harris is kind of a unique opportunity that has opened up for people to talk about Indian Americans' political and civic life that may not have otherwise existed? Mira?
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing, everything about her candidacy is absolutely historic. And I think that it has spurred, at the very least, a conversation surrounding Indians in politics, what their role will be, how do we support that, do we support that? I just think those conversations have never had to happen before until now. And I think it's just, you know, everything from her gender, the timeline, her heritage is completely historic. And that's why, I mean, even when I talk to my family in India, they're like, we've never known who the vice president of the United States is, but she is on the news. Mm-hmm. And so we care about it.
Yeah. Jacob?
I think as a multiracial Black Indian woman with those heritage, I think you have opportunities for multiple dialogue. What she does in office yet is to be remained red. I think it opens a door to a lot of conversations around intergroup relations between the Black and Indian community in particular and the experiences of multiracial people, absolutely. And we're seeing how not a monolith our community is in politics.
Yeah. And Arindam? It was a picture that you posted that kind of got all of this started. So what are your thoughts on this?
Sure. Before I get to that, I echo Jacob's point. I think the dialogue between communities, which hasn't happened, at least from the Indian American perspective that we are connected, is huge. And I think Vice President Harris does allow for that opportunity. But yeah, to your point, you know, and this is connects with Mira's point too. I have five kids, four of whom are daughters. And while my parents had Indira Gandhi and saw a woman leader, my kids have never seen that in this country. So mm-hmm. I think that connection and that identification is why, you know, my younger ones are talking about Kamala Aunty all the time. Mm-hmm. It's something exciting for them. So.
And wearing a t-shirt.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So. Arindam Kaur is a longtime resident of St. Louis and an attorney at the law firm Polsinelli. Jacob Chacko is the executive director for the Center of Diversity and Inclusion at Washington University. And Mira Nagarajan is a journalist and travel advisor. Thank you, all of you, for joining us today.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Elaine Cha.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr.
This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.